We're in Isaiah. This is actually the ninth lesson in Isaiah. And it seems like you've hardly scratched the surface. It's such a textured book. I mean, there are so many different things to consider. Now, what we've said thematically is that it's very messianic. It's called upon constantly in the New Testament to give shape and a picture to who Jesus really is. A lot of it there, quoted probably more than any other book in terms of frequency, or at least referred to. The imagery of the New Testament just continually calls back to Isaiah to show who we're dealing with in Christ. We said there are, of course, other things going on in prophetic writings. We talked about the layered nature of prophecy, that there seems to be fulfillment and then real fulfillment, or the one layer of fulfillment then becomes yet a confirmation, perhaps a foreshadowing of what's to really take place. So it looks to a more immediate history, and then it looks out beyond that for its so you might say actual fulfillment, or its complete fulfillment. Although I know that's a redundancy, right? Fulfillment by definition is complete. And we thought, well, there are interesting ones. There are favorite passages in Isaiah that a lot of people know. There are less well-known things. Last week we looked at what group of people?
Moabites.
The Moabites. And that's probably not from Isaiah 14, 15. That's probably not a real famous passage from Isaiah, but it does give us a look into that world. And we found that even those passages have a messianic quality. They look at the nation of Moab and what's going to happen to it immediately, but they somehow look out into the future and say, but look ahead, look way out there about what God's to do. And we saw Jesus even showed up in that picture as well. Today's something similar. We're going to look at Isaiah chapter 29. It's probably not, you might know some of these phrases from Bible reading at different places. There's only one set of verses I think is really famous within the context of the New Testament. One of the things you know about prophets is, as I said, they're not just about trying to give freaky facts to astound people so that they have to believe it at the other end of it. I mean, they're looking into situations and saying, this is what God is really doing here and now. It works real well for them, I think, when they're denouncing other people's sins. This kind of ties into themes we're talking about here this morning, right? When prophets are denouncing other nations like Moab, they've got a big cheering session. Yeah, let's hear it for our God who's about to stomp the Moabites, or to let Egypt finally know who's boss, or to take down the brutal Assyrian Empire. Of course, that's... everybody likes to hear that kind of prophecy, right? But the trouble where prophets run into trouble then is, and then they turn and they start to speak about God's people. They start to speak about, and you. And they almost seem harsher at that point. Like, these were the pagan nations, and you, though, who have no excuse whatsoever. And that's when it gets dicey in the career of prophets. Things get dangerous for them. So, Isaiah 29, we turn our attention to Jerusalem. And Jerusalem, of course, is the heart of the matter as far as Isaiah is concerned. That's where he lives. That's where he works. That's where he speaks. So, let's look at Isaiah 29. I want you to read, somebody to read for us the first six verses of it. And we'll take them apart after that. I don't think there are any terrible, after our last experiences when he's mentioning place names in Moab and things, that of course gives a real tongue twister to the reader. There's not much here that's going to be difficult to read, or I'd cue you on pronunciation. So somebody please, the first six verses of Isaiah 29. Wonderful passage. You probably, if you're following along in translations, a classic case of we're dealing with poetry here and translations aren't going to match real well. What's Jerusalem's name in this? Ariel. And there's a lot of... Does anybody have anything else there, Bunny? Some modern translations might even play with this particular name. What does this term mean? Yeah, that's you've got a good footnote there. Altar covered with blood. covered. It was the hearthstone, you know, some people think maybe a hearthstone, you know, around an altar or something like that where blood would be poured out. That's one confident assertion. Is that the only one your Bible gives? Or does it say, or alternatively? There are usually two ones. It's interesting to see why I picked, because no one's been able to settle exactly why this name and exactly what does it mean. Now, it would make a lot of sense if it's what John points here, because what's in Jerusalem? The temple. I mean, that's where the sacrifices happen. And so that image really matches it. But there are a lot, you might have another Bible that talks about this as Lion of God. And there's a strong tendency if you're parsing the name, you know, you probably know what your name means, right? You know, and you think, well, how did they get that? You know, I mean, what does that mean? You know, why does it mean that? When you start taking apart names that, you know, and you get different derivations of what names mean, this could be Lion of God. So sometimes Bible footnotes will say, Ariel, you know, it's altar covered with blood. Or sometimes Ariel, this means Lion of God. Ari, the name, and El, you know, of the Most High. Okay. Well, so we've got this picture of it. Well, what's going to happen? You've got six verses here, and this is probably the kind of thing you don't know right offhand if you're reading Isaiah or saying, let's get to the good stuff that we know from the New Testament. But what's going to happen in the first six verses here according to this passage? Yeah, the city will be besieged. And there are a couple of things we've got to look at here. What do you know about the history of Jerusalem and sieges? There are a few of them, right? And sieges are ugly things. This is the oldest idea of kind of civilization. Cities, you know, by in the historical development, they start to build walls. Well, walls are fabulous at keeping people out, but of course, anytime you build a fence, it can keep people in, right? I mean, it has both things. And so it doesn't take long for the idea of siege in warfare to take place. In other words, you get on this kind of agreement, well, people get behind their wall and they see how long they can hold out, and people outside see if they can do what?
Wait them out,
and they do tricky things, you know, to do it. They have the sappers and people who try to bring the walls down, and, you know, you throw things over the walls, and you taunt and hassle, and see if you can cut off water and starve them out of there. And, well, there are interesting things. They say, actually, this has absolutely nothing to do with this, except it's interesting. In English history, Alfred the Great, you know who he is, you know, first great English king, and they said that up to this point, they had to deal with the Danes of all people, you know, and you know, the Danes are scary, aren't they? Well, they were Vikings. So they'd taken over England. Well, they'd build fortified cities, and the Saxons just kept attacking them, and they kept losing. You know, they couldn't go against the walled city. And they said Alfred had this brilliant idea, which is go around, quit attacking their strong place. You know, just go do whatever you're going to do and let them stay inside their fence. And in fact, they're trapped there. And so it was a kind of a brilliant moment in British history when he realized just because they have a big fort there doesn't mean you have to attack it. You know, and so that was kind of an interesting moment. In the history of Israel, we've got a couple big sieges. One of them, the big scary empire at this point is whom? Assyria. Assyria is bad news. And they're going to come and actually, remember, they take down Israel and Syria. They're probably the ones who are going to get the Moabites and others. And they do get to Jerusalem and they siege it. But in 701 before the time of Christ, you know, 700 years before the time of Christ, actually that siege is lifted and Jerusalem is delivered, but only for a little while. There will be another siege in a matter of, how many years? I mean, just take a wild, you know, you might say 150 years, I think, is what you're going to look at. Maybe not quite that long. When the Babylonians will come and they will siege it. And, of course, that siege lasts. Do you remember how it ends?
Badly.
Well, remember the king Zedekiah, he does the brave thing, which with a few of his men, he tries to dig a hole in the wall and escape. They catch him, and what do they do? I think they kill his sons in front of him and take his eyes out, don't they? And well, of course, the king, the leadership, leaves and leaves the city to its horrible fate. And the Babylonians crack down the wall and they take people off into the Babylonian captivity. all is history. We've been reviewing this, right? Remember, the northern kingdom gets stomped by Israel, or Israel gets stomped by Assyria, taken into Assyria, never comes back. The invitations to them are to come back when the Messiah comes. The southern kingdom around Jerusalem survives the Assyrian threat, but is taken down finally by the Babylonians, taken into captivity for 70-some years, then comes back and rebuilds Jerusalem and the temple, and is the landscape to which Jesus is born, right? I mean, that's the kingdom that continues there. So, it's hard to say when we talk about this siege here as to what the fulfillment is of this prophecy in a sense. As I said, there's layering always in prophecy. I will lay a siege against you in a mound. I will raise siege works against you. You shall be brought down. You shall speak out of the ground. Now think about poetically here. Your speech shall be low out of the dust. Your voice will be like a medium's out of the ground, and your speech shall whisper out of the dust. Think poetically here. What are we talking about? Oh yeah, but how does something speak out of the dust? What's the image? Dead. Yeah, well, how does something speak from... I mean, think of Jerusalem. Rubble. Who said it? Yeah, very good. I mean, then how does rubble speak? Well, I just had to get the poetry here. I mean, rubble is eloquent, isn't it? Ruins speak loudly. What do they say? Well, defeat. Something was here and now it's gone. You know, and depending on the nature of the rubble, it might say other things to you, you know, but it is a very poetic image, right? What's left of you is going to have to speak up out of the dust. It's going to be like a medium, a necromancer, you know, somebody who's you know, tells you what the dead are saying. You know, Jerusalem, are you in there? What are you saying? Well, what is Jerusalem saying?
We should have listened.
We should have done it differently. Well, it's a very interesting thing, and when you look at this, so we're talking about Israel, or excuse me, we're talking about Jerusalem, and we're seeing that how days of distress, heaviness and sorrow, and God is going to raise the speech up out of them, and apparently they're going to go down into the dust. Now, the question is that I have here, I mean, who's going to do this to them? God. Well, that's interesting because we think, well, we have some big scary people, Assyria, and then ultimately the Babylonians. They're not scary at this point at all. I mean, they're actually look kind of friendly. But the Assyrians, they think, but it's not saying the Assyrians will camp around you. He says, I will encamp around you. I will lay siege against you. I will raise siege works. You will be brought down. Now, that means God's going to do it. Well, how's this look for God to you? Is this the picture of God you carry in your mind? Well, no, it's kind of, you know, well, you know, when you think about this, I mean, we can say, we're trying to figure out, we read this prophet who's used, called upon, as I said, constantly to tell us who Jesus is, and we see the character of God here, and we say, well, what about this God who raises a siege work against Jerusalem? Does it raise any questions for you immediately about God's character and justice? Well, it does to me. I mean, I would say that look, sweep away all the idiots, please, but not, don't take me with them. I mean, it's a collective judgment against an entire city, right? Now, you say, well, is that fair? You know, wouldn't everybody by different degrees have different levels of punishment in store, right? You know, like, hey, look, you know, I'm just a little bit evil, but my neighbor over here, you know, I mean, maybe, you know, I could get, you know, a couple days without water, food, probably asking for it. But, you know, as for, you know, him, you know, he should starve to death and suffer and, you know. Well, that's one question. But do you think... We say God is what? God is loving. God is kind. God is merciful. God is full of redemption. And then you'd have to say, then why does he do this? Well, okay, so we've got God with two faces. When he's looking, these are eyes and nose here. When he's looking this way, it's like, it's angry. How do you make angry eyebrows? But when he looks this way, it's all smiles, you know? Good Lord, I need to learn how to draw. Well, why don't you come up and draw for me? You can do this. We'll say like a God with two faces.
Look, you know what I'm saying. Look, you'll remember that illustration long after. If I could do one of these magnificent chalk drawings, I'd do it. But just say, well, does this make God schizophrenic, though? That every once, for the most part, he's loving and kind, but you've got to watch him, because every once in a while, he looks at you with the other face, and he's really mad at you. And it's kind of unpredictable, and you better get out of his way. Ah, so his purpose is redemptive. His purpose might even be said to be loving, right? And kind. Now, when you say priority, are you saying that God's a slight more wrathful than loving, or... I think we really need to get sophisticated a little bit when we think about God. If we love God, if we're Christians, we better think about God. I mean, there's something wrong if somebody says, "Well, I don't want to think about that." You think, but I thought you were Christian. I thought we're all about loving God and becoming one with Him. Say, God is perfect. God does not change. God doesn't experience emotion quite the same way we do, in that his temper flares or that he's capricious in some way. So whatever God is like, he is like that all the time. It would be part of his essential attribute. So if he is wrathful about sin or angry about sin, he's like that always, without exception, without fault. He doesn't turn it on once in a while and turn it off. And if he's loving all the time in all ways. And so his love must be not just be compatible, but kind of insist upon, a relentless wrath against sin and against problems. Now, we have to figure out, well, why is he doing this to them? Remember, we said that there was a problem in Moab that seemed to make the prophecy come against them. Do you remember what the problem in Moab was? We said there was a characteristic that seemed to speak of Moab. Pride. Yeah, over and over we said in Jeremiah and Isaiah, it's their pride. Now, exactly how that pride exhibited itself in Moab, but the smug, haughty pride that of Moab brought them. Guess what? We haven't got a notion quite yet as to what Ariel has done here, at least in this part of the book, right? Well, anyway, I think, why does God do this? Well, it is consistent completely with his love and character and his redemptive purposes. But it's certainly the side, we don't even want to talk about it as a side, but it's not the kind of development we would like to see. Now, let's look at 7 through 9. Somebody read us 7 through 9. This is going to come upon Ariel. It's going to come upon Jerusalem. God says, "I'm going to do it." And so far, we still don't really have the sentence again, why the sentence is being pronounced. But he does say some interesting things about the foes here. First of all, let's just go back up here. We say they'll be punished with storm and tempest and flame of devouring earthquake and great noise and thunder. What does that sound like to you? Once again, speaking poetically, I say. Yeah, we've got one of those going now. Did you read that the lava flows from some of those things in Indonesia are going 60 miles an hour? Well, I always wonder, like, having grown up on cheesy films from the 1950s, the lava coming down the mountains always seems like it's going real slow, Think, well, get out of there, Don't you know it's coming? Is it getting a little warm? And if you read about that, 60 miles per hour. I mean, there are people trying to outrun it on motorcycles and stuff like that over in Indonesia. This is pertinent to what we're saying here. How do you picture this thing happening, going down here in verse 6? Thunder, earthquake, great noise, storm, tempest, flame of devouring fire. Catastrophic, sudden, noisy, conspicuous, and very public. I mean, all those things speak of a kind of an objective quality, that not kind of maybe an insidious rot that happens slowly. I mean, there are God's judgments that happen that way, aren't there? The sort of slow deterioration. Not in this case. Seems like it's going to happen very, very publicly and very dramatically. But then, in 7, don't you detect kind of a change? How is that pictured? The people who are going to be the means, the mechanism of God's judgment. Try to get the images again.
as a dream.
The multitude of nations who fight against her and distress her shall be as a dream of a night vision. And what are the two dreams he puts up there? A hungry person and a thirsty person. And they're dreaming about food and drink. And of course they wake up, and how do they experience things? Yeah, they're like, you know, people out on the life raft floating around dreaming about steak dinners and what, you know, if they're rescued, what they will eat. But they wake up and they realize then there's, it's not there, it's not real. Well, what does this say then about the people who have come against Jerusalem? Well, that the defeat of Jerusalem is going to be just profoundly unsatisfying. It will only appear to them for a moment to be what they thought it to be. Because God's doing it, God's got his purposes. But the nations that are executing this will are going to find it very, very unsatisfying. It isn't going to be fulfilling their particular agenda. I mean, they'll gloat for a moment, but in fact, their gloating's all in vain because they're like a hungry man dreaming of food. And people talked about, I mean, just for parallels, poetic parallels, I don't know that you can say this is true as we draw it out of the passage in all cases, but people gloat over the ruin of the church or the falling apart of a Christian life, you know, or when, you know, Christians get theirs. I mean, to say it may all be quite premature, right? Because God works out his purposes. And the castigator, do you know what I'm talking about here? The punisher doesn't have a right or doesn't... It will not find it a satisfying experience. They are merely being used by God to execute his purposes, not the purposes of a worldly agenda. There would be lots of people who would be bringing down Jerusalem for their own reasons, not for God's reasons. So that's a real interesting set of image, right? And of course, you know where Mount Zion is, right? That is Jerusalem, another way of looking at this. All right, let's look at the next set of verses. Would somebody read us 9 through 13? Okay. Well, that's an interesting set of images, right? Now, you're familiar with this idea of this idea of intoxication. But Deanne said beer. I have intoxicating drinks here. Remember, what did alcoholic beverages consist of back in these days? Fermentation. I mean, they didn't have distilled alcohol, right? I mean, you teetotalers know the difference, right? I'm a teetotaler too, by the way, but I didn't grow up one, you know. But I mean, it's amazing to me when I talk to people who grew up in the church, of course, that you know they don't know alcoholic drinks. So we wouldn't have distilled drinks, right? Distilled alcohol is much stronger, you know, than something that's merely fermented. I mean, beer and wine have only varying degrees of alcohol from fermentation. They didn't have vodka back in Jerusalem and things like that. But what's the state of intoxication? Oh, blindness, drunkenness. What's it say, though, about a person's spiritual, or their condition, what God's pronouncing for them here? And you have to say, why would God do this to people? In other words, if he's concerned about a situation there, and we say he laid siege works against them, but now he's saying, all right, wouldn't you say, well, wouldn't the message be, sober up? Think clearly. Open your eyes. Wake up. Don't be unperceiving. But in fact, he's saying, blind yourselves and be blind. They are drunk. They stagger. The Lord has poured out on you the spirit of a deep sleep. Closed your eyes. And who are the eyes? Prophets. How are prophets the eyes? Well, and the seers are the what? The head. How does that work? Well, you have to think about it. I mean, this is the drunkenness. You know, this is I'm going to produce this in the people. This is probably what the big word is, a parallelism. In other words, you shouldn't probably think there's a difference between a seer and a prophet necessarily. But this is what's going to happen. Remember, I said prophets aren't just about telling the future. They're about seeing into the situation and seeing what God's doing. And, you know, they're not just about predicting fabulous details for the future, but helping you to understand what's going on and why it's happening. And he's saying that I'm closing your eye, the spirit of a deep sleep closed your eyes, so the prophets apparently aren't going to be able to speak, and the seers apparently aren't going to be able to be heard. And you would have to say once again, is why is God doing this to them? Finally, we get to the indictment. What's the problem here? Verse 13. Yeah, we say, these people draw near with their mouths, honor me with their lips. What's that sound like? All right, formalized religion, right? I mean, it says the right things, but it doesn't have an internal aspect that turns to God. Now, thank goodness no Christians ever like that. We never go through the moves, right? We never say what's expected. I mean, we're always just, speak directly and honestly from our internal condition. So we can go right past this one. What have they done, actually, in fact? Keep looking at 13. In fact, they've removed their hearts from the Lord, right? And their fear toward me is what?
Man-made,
the commandments of men. Now, this is a really fascinating thing, because this passage is the familiar one, or at least it should be for you from the New Testament. Do you know where this is mentioned? All right, well, let's look at Matthew 15. You could see the parallel story in Mark, but let's just look at 15. Our old friends, the scribes and Pharisees, are back at it. You've seen them already in action this morning. And somebody read us Matthew 15, and we're going to see, once again, Isaiah employed to describe what Jesus is doing. So, would somebody read us 15? I think we need to go through at least verse... All right. Well, explain this to me in terms of religion. See, all right, Jesus, we don't need to study the Matthew passage there. They had a dodge in their religion in which it sort of gutted God's intention that we honor our mother and father, and it was a pious reason why they wouldn't have to take care of mother and father. It's an interesting story, but we don't need to go there. But in fact, they gutted God's commandment and taught in its place a commandment of men, and their hearts were far from God. Well, tell me, how does this work? Well, that's what seems the scribes and Pharisees with their honor your mother and father thing. Say, if we were going to do a study on Matthew there, we'd have to take that apart. But in fact, it has kind of a pious progression, where we're doing this for God, and Jesus saying, no, you're not, you're not drawing near to me. What were you going to say, Vicki? Yeah, it seems to me there's it's kind of a monstrous quality towards our religion. We build religious institutions and we create religion, and of course it human rules get in there really fast because they're measurable and they're understandable, and we can't look into the heart anyway. I mean, there's this real religion happens inside you where the rest of us don't look really or can't look, and so. But we it's very easy to build kind of religious rules and religious ideas and religiosity. And to me, as I said, it seems like in the scriptures anyway, at least as often as not, it becomes a monstrosity. I mean, it becomes a human house of cards, and it's sort of agitating against real religious stuff that's happening inside of you. Now, the question for me to you is, how guilty are we of this? Or maybe we should take the prophetic approach and say, how guilty are those horrible sinners over at the Assembly of God of this? Well, I just say, you look out across the church and you say, thank God that doesn't apply to me. Or do you think, uh-oh. It's a shame I've only gotten halfway through my lesson here. And, because the rest of the chapter really brings some of this around, I think, and raises some interesting questions. But I'm kind of out of time here. I guess the question, I mean, where I would leave it if I have to leave it here and not do the rest of chapter 29 is, what do we do about it? I mean, my view is it's probably always a tendency for the human being to create religions that are the mere commandments of men. I mean, that is a perverse tendency in us all at all times because of our wicked nature. Now, the question maybe to end on is, let's not go away depressed. What do we do about that? Or maybe that'll depress us more. I don't know. Now, it seems that God is opposed enough to this in his very being to want to sweep Jerusalem clean and start from the ground up. I mean, the whole nature of the siege and the idea of speaking from the rubble is that I'm not going to work in this or work through it. I'm going to knock it down. And all that judgment and all that intoxication really is sort of the radical surgery that's necessary in order to complete his redemptive and loving purpose for people. To knock that down and make sure that it's gone, that you can only be fascinated with the rubble of it. Say, but how do we do that?
Yeah, I think the Holy Spirit's our hope here, you know, for...
Well, you're right. I mean, you know, there's ample warning, and what comes on them suddenly has really been brewing for a long time at this point. My suggestion is, what do you do about this? Is you never make room for the commandments of men, and you realize it's a perverse religious streak that we all carry in our hearts, and that it can't be worked with. It needs to be knocked down and speak from the rubble. I mean, we should be in a sense like God and just take that down and not accept that, not play with that, but realize that the only thing that matters is drawing near to the Lord in truth and in your heart, and not by following the commandments of men. So that's my final word. And the second half of the chapter is cool, but maybe I'll get to it next week, or maybe I'll just move on.